players and legends
to the very best analysts around the world from wherever the beautiful game is played.
This is BTP.
Now, we're talking football.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Beyond the Pitch. I'm Juan Arango. Thank you so much for being with us. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing someone that I really wanted to in a long time because of my relationship with him. A very good guy, a very knowledgeable individual when it comes to the game of football. I guess he should be. He was part of the 2006 Trinidad and Tobago national team that went to the World Cup in Germany. He's not only a footballer, he's also been a politician, he's been a coach, he's been a team owner, he's been involved with lots of things within Trinidad and Tobago, within the Caribbean as well. He currently is also an analyst with Sportsmax in the Caribbean. He'll be part of their World Cup coverage this summer when they really delve into what goes on in the World Cup. So looking forward to that from him as well. He goes into this interview and he talks about pretty much what is going on with things in the Caribbean as far as Caribbean football is concerned. First and foremost, the biggest priority, the CONCACAF Nations League. He talks about the growing pains, the positives, the negatives, and everything that needs to be worked around in order to make this tournament, this competition, more successful, but also more profitable and a way for people to be able to improve, for the level of football to improve in the Caribbean and within CONCACAF as well. He talks about the issues going on in Trinidadian football from the financial end, from the logistical end, and also from the developmental end. He talks about that in depth. He talks about a lot of issues. We even go into Champions League because obviously he is doing Champions League coverage for Sportsmax as well. He talks about what's going on with Real Madrid, with Roma, with Liverpool, everything that goes on as far as the Champions League semifinals are concerned. And more importantly, I think this is probably a very juicy part for many of you that are listening. He talks about that night in Cuba back in October when he was pretty much around the Trinidadian national team. He was doing some media coverage as well. And he talked about everything from the mood and how it changed from one moment to another when Bruce Arena started making his comments and when some players started talking about what occurred in the days leading up to that match, the motivation that it created, and also the environment that it created within Trinidad itself. Very interesting to hear that perspective. Very interesting to hear what Brent Sancho has to say. Again, to me, a guy that really has a lot of good takes, has a lot of good opinions, has a lot of very well-informed opinions, obviously, but also he has a great pulse on what's going on in the game in the Caribbean and elsewhere. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Also, please, I ask of you to subscribe on iTunes. Make sure that you don't miss an episode of Beyond the Pitch. Phil and I are always looking to be able to offer you the best content possible with the best personalities, pundits, players, etc., etc., etc. One star is great. Okay, we know there's room for improvement. Five stars. Hey, man, you guys are legends. Thank you so much, and we appreciate it. Also, check me out on BTP Daily. You can also subscribe through iTunes. You can also subscribe through various other platforms, Stitcher, Audio Boom, whatever. You can do that for both BTP and for Beyond the Pitch as well. Also, before I forget, subscribe over at my YouTube channel. It's called The Normal Juan. You guys made the name, so all the information and all the content will be for you. Remember, it's The Normal Juan on YouTube. Subscribe and hope you don't miss a single episode there. So without much further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the one and only Brent Sancho. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Beyond the Pitch. I'm Juan Arango, and it's a pleasure to be with you guys again. And it's a pleasure to be with the guy that I guess I've pseudo worked with. I might have been in studio with him a couple of times. I don't remember, and I forgive. You know, I ask for forgiveness if I don't remember. And I was great guy. You know, he's part of a band of you know, really intriguing personalities down in Trinidad. Him alongside Angus Eve, Joel Villafana, and a whole cast of characters that I've had the pleasure of working with. I'll add him on just because I like him and he's a cool guy. World Cup man, Soca warrior, and has played in England, has played all over the place. Mr. Brent Sancho, how are you, sir? How's everything going in Jamaica right now?
It's been great, great weather, as you would expect here in the beautiful island of Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And a lot of talking points around football, of course, Champions League in the air here in Jamaica, and as well, by extension, the Caribbean. And, of course, local mm-hmm. football, there are a couple local friendlies. Jamaica played St. Kitts and Antigua. So there's a lot of conversation on the sport here on the island. But good to hear your voice.
Yeah, man. It's like every time I've been down there, you're gone, but we kind of cross paths, but very briefly. And that's what really sucked. I wanted to sit down, have a couple of Red Stripe or a couple of, a little bit of coffee or something like that to be able just to shoot the shit, just be able to.
Red Stripe sounds better than coffee.
Well, yeah, especially when it's cold. Excuse me, when it's warm. Yeah, I think a Red Stripe sounds a lot better. But Brent, exactly. let's talk a little bit about what you were saying. Jamaica playing St. Kitts, and also a lot of what's going on with the Nations League in CONCACAF. How I got to speak to Jason Roberts a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how important this is for the development of the game in places like the Caribbean. How have you seen it so far? How has Trinidad, specifically in your case, been looking at it as far as a developmental opportunity?
Well, there is the pros and cons as it relates to the Nations League. I think when it was first unfolded, I think that the smaller islands in the Caribbean, in the region in particular, seems to be the main benefactor of this league. First and foremost, as you would be aware, getting international games during the carded international friendly schedule during the course of the year can be a challenge for some of these smaller nations. And to stay competitive is also a challenge. And one of the points that the nation leagues came out of is, of course, the fact that these teams get knocked out quite early in the World Cup reckoning, and, of course, the CONCACAF Gold Cup as well reckoning. So they are very much limited to the amount of international friendlies that they would see during the course of the footballing calendar year. So this in particular, I think, would benefit those smaller countries. We mentioned St. Kitts and Antigua in particular. Those types of countries would benefit significantly from it because they will be seeing a significant amount of games, more than they used to, and against that probably wouldn't be playing against. So I think that's one of the benefits as it relates to the smaller nation. I think countries like Trinidad and Jamaica and Haiti, by extension, fears that they would be stuck in playing quote-unquote mediocre games throughout the course of the year. Of course, Trinidad getting a favorable draw because of our hex finish, but Jamaica and Haiti not as fortunate. So the concern is the type of games. Of course, Jamaica, for example, played South Korea this year. I think they played Saudi Arabia in a closed-door game. So they're one of the Caribbean islands that get quite decent international friendlies throughout, and now they have to play sort of in their region throughout the year. So it might be a bit of a holdback. One of the interesting arguments, Juan, if I may continue, is that coming out of the Nations League is the players now have more international games, which will solve the conundrum of the nation not having enough games. But one of the challenges is the actual players. The players from these smaller islands are not playing in decent domestic leagues. And I think that is one of the drawbacks with the Nations League. Yes, they're getting more games at an international level, but the actual grassroots and development of more players, I think, is a real challenge, because at the end of the day, you would want players to be playing at a high domestic league and a decent level, because they would only play roughly about 8 international games a year. And if they're not playing week in, week out at a decent domestic league standard, I think the challenges will still be there.
Yeah, it kind of defeats the purpose, with that's what you're saying, pretty much.
Yeah, so you're just really papering over the cracks. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see, and it's something, of course, mentioned by the president of the TTFA, David John Williams, is seeing some of these better players from these smaller islands, whether it's through subsidies, etc., being put into leagues like Trinidad, Jamaica, Haiti, and of course Dominican Republic now with this thriving league that they have, that would now give them the opportunity to develop training at a high level every day, and of course playing at a decent level every day. And I think that tied that into the Nations League, and I think you have a winner.
Yeah, it's interesting the concepts that you're putting out there, Brent, because obviously what the Dominican Republic's been able to do and how Cibao was able to perform against Chivas, that also put them, I guess, in a way, put them on the map as far as the competitiveness or the willingness to compete at a high level within the Caribbean and also within CONCACAF. But also, what's most telling it and what the effort, at least, that's being made to try and close, I mean, that enormous gulf of difference between North American teams, and then you have another tier with the Central American teams, and then you have another significant a bit of a distance, maybe not as much, between the Central American teams and the Caribbean teams, that's trying to be closed off a little bit more. But it's going to be a process. It's going to be a few years when you start really seeing some countries begin to truly make inroads, because, I mean, when you look at the development of a concept like this, people are looking for results, you know, pretty much on an immediate basis.
Yeah. And you're right. And at the end of the day, I understand what, CONCACAF is trying to do as it relates to more match days for these countries. But, of course, as a former player, my concern is the player itself. Now, there's been a lot of conversation within CONCACAF about a Caribbean Professional League as well, which would mandate, of course, teams from the bigger islands to participate in a little bit longer version of the CFU Club Championship. I think the challenge with that is that for the last 2 years or so, particularly so in Trinidad, club football has struggled a bit because of the economic situation there, where oil prices is not where it was before,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't had the same kind of governmental buy-in that you would have had 3 or 4 years ago, and corporate buying for
yeah.
that fact.
Yeah.
So because of that, you're seeing the challenges, and players from Trinidad, the better players, are now going in their droves to the Central American leagues, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, etc., to ply their trade, which is leaving a bit of a brain drain here in Trinidad and Tobago.
Brent, what I'm, and it's something that people maybe here in the United States and in parts of North America really don't realize. Because for us, you know, jump on a plane and you go from one end of the country to the other, it's, you know, maybe a $400, $500 trip. But to fly within the Caribbean is a very exhausting, it's a very logistically challenging type of ordeal because of the expense, because of, and you mentioned that the oil prices too as well. I mean, for Caribbean countries to be able to go from one end to the other, I mean, it becomes a very costly thing just to go and play one match too.
Yeah, and I think that is the backdrops of some of the issues that CONCACAF has to solve if this Caribbean Professional League is to come into fruition. I mean, you don't have to look too far, Juan, and of course you have an example in the CPL, which is the cricket Caribbean Professional League, but that runs for a shorter time. It's approximately 2 months or so. As you would know, football
season
will be a lot longer, and they have not broken positive figures yet since the start of the CPL, the Cricket Professional League in the Caribbean. They're still running at a deficit, and they're still struggling. And one of their major, line items is the cost of travel. It is a big issue, as you rightfully mentioned. I mean, I've flown from Trinidad to Jamaica, and I can tell you, a round trip ticket is about $600-$700 US.
I mean, let me put that in perspective for you. I mean, how expensive that is. A round trip ticket from Miami to Buenos Aires is $800-$900, and that's a 9-hour flight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
well,
crazy.
It's funny because I contemplated coming through Miami. Mm-hmm. Because it was cheaper to get to Miami. It's $300 US to get to Miami.
Mm.
But it's a topic, and then you can add the fact that there's not reliable air services to the Caribbean, because the air bridges for the respective Caribbean countries struggle with the inter-island travel.
Mm.
So the major issue that you are hearing coming out of CONCACAF is the air travel. And then the second issue, of course, is the franchises. Whether or not there's enough interest or persons with the financial clout to be able to take on such an undertaking. But, I mean, in all the conversations that we've had with CONCACAF, we just came out of a meeting in December, the CONCACAF draw, the noises are still there. They still an honest approach to try to bring it to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something that they truly want to experiment and see if they can take it off the drawing board and into reality.
Yeah, I find that amazing, and you're right about that, because and also to add, the Cricket League had probably bigger investors. If you start looking, one of the examples was a few years ago when the Jamaica Talawas had Gerard Butler is one of their as one of their investors. I mean, they've had some heavy hitters in there, and they're still not really being able to get out of the red yet. And it's a process, and that's, I think, what people that are looking at this type of tournament, of this type of endeavor, it's a process, and things are going to have to take 5, maybe 6, 7 years to really start to see true results and see differences begin to erode a little bit, if you will. And it's interesting that you bring that up, to Brent, because of your administrative side. The past few years, you've been coaching, you were a team owner. At one point, you were also part of what's, you're trying to get the Trinidadian FA back into form the past few years. How is that, going on all aspects for you? How do you see, specifically in Trinidad, things getting better, or things just still struggling after everything that occurred a few years ago?
Well, one of the things is, for your listeners to understand, mm-hmm. is that for the past 20 to 30 years, Trinidad and Tobago has been under the stewardship of Jack Warner. And Jack Warner, larger-than-life personality, whether you hate him or love him, had basically the run of the rule as it relates to the direction of football in the Caribbean, not just Trinidad and Tobago. And, of course, once he departed from football, they left it, there was a vacuum that was left. And the sad thing, and one of the negatives, is that there wasn't no real direction as to where football on the island was heading. It was just under the whim of what Mr. Warner wanted to do. And again, as I said, whether you love him or hate him, there were positives and negatives to his tenure in Trinidad. But that being said, moving forward, there seems to be a genuine want for betterment. The struggles is here on the island is the fact that, there's a lot of persons that have their views as the way forward, and no one seems to want to follow one view.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several different views that's causing a lot of infighting and lack of progress. And the sad thing about it,
yeah.
as well, Juan, is that it will have its side effects. And one of the side effects is a lack of corporate support and by extension, government support, because of some of the articles that may be coming out from the Trinidad and Tobago football fraternity and some of the corporate entities wanting to stay away. It's already a challenge, as you would know, for any football organization, clubs, etc., that ply under the umbrella of football to operate with lack of funding. And that has been the challenge for the last 3 to 4 years, is the funding and, of course, the infighting that has been taking place. Some of the conversations have been constructive, but the one view or the one direction has not happened here yet in Trinidad. And again, it's because of the backdrops of the vacuum that Mr. Warner would have left when he departed from football. So the challenge really is to get that one view and that one direction to push the football
yeah.
forward. What is remarkable about all of this is that we are still producing some very talented players. However, what you find coming out is that because of the lack of funding, is that we don't have enough qualified coaches coming through the island. We were a little bit fortunate over the last year for the likes of Dennis Lawrence to be coming back, who's had a good career in Europe, Stern John, who's had also a good career, Angus Eve, and some of the players that would have played the sport at a very high level have now turned to coaching, but just not enough at the grassroots level. And so what you find happening is that the players that are developing, they're very good athletically, talented, but technically and mentally, they're way short from what is required for international level.
I'm here with Brent Sancho on Beyond the Pitch. Brent, and you talk about that, and some of the young players, and always the one that I've always comes to mind when it comes to Trinidadian football, maybe the past year and a half or so, tends to be Levi Garcia. And players like that, is there something that you know, as soon as they have a chance to go, they do it, and sometimes they do it in a way that may be a little bit economically hasty for them, meaning that the first time a team offers them any type of money, they leave. Is that been a situation too, and that kind of also hinders their development a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely, and it goes back to the structure that we talked about. One of the challenges here is the fact that there's no real structure at the grassroots level, and there's no real one thought or one vision being pushed at the grassroots level. So players that may be a little bit technically better than others, and also physically and athletically better, they seem to lack the mental capacity to play at the next level. So that is a challenge. And now, because of what is happening here on the island, players are leaving a bit earlier. To whatever offer they may get, they're ready to rush and go out. And they may not be ready for that just yet. And we've had instances where players would have gone out and bounced back to Trinidad because they just weren't ready for that level of football. So that is what you see. And if Levi Garcia is a perfect case. I mean, he got a dream move over to AZ, and he just wasn't able to cut it. And behind Levi, there's not really anyone of that ilk coming through the system. So you'd have to wonder, what can we do better here in Trinidad and Tobago to develop these players to at least stick when they go outside? And that is the challenge. It goes back to what I said originally. Of course, with the funding and the lack of coaches at that level, you tend to find yourself in a little bit of a sticky situation.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that after Levi Garcia, there really isn't – there's maybe a drop-off in talent development or what have you. What have you seen an issue in which, I mean, I've seen a lot, and I've talked to obviously a lot. I talk a bit to Angus Eve on occasion, and he's talked about it. I mean, he was even coaching at a university level to be able to start to get the grassroots going a little bit. I mean, you've been involved to a certain extent with the grassroots level in Trinidad. How is that? I mean, how can that be fixed? Yet you have the conundrum on the other end, because of lack of private investment, not really being able to get sponsors still. How do those situations, how can they get fixed? In going to that, how are many of that 2006 generation coming in and really trying to pitch in and really using their good name, using their good influence, their positive influence in order to rectify the situation?
Well, there's been a really interesting development happening in Trinidad and Tobago as it relates to the grassroots level. There's been more participation because the current administration has gone out and really tried to get into every nook and cranny to get more kids playing. Now, in terms of developing that special talent or developing the young kid at 9 and 10, et cetera, and 11, there's a core of what I would call more elite persons in Trinidad in terms of financing, some financially well-off persons in Trinidad. Their children have been more involved in the sport, and they form their teams kind of in their own little personal private groups, and they've been taking their kids to the Barcelonas and all these other places for camps and training and whatnot. And what you'll find at the national level is that this group of players have been winning tournaments inside out locally on the island simply because, A, they're exposed to better standard of play, and they've exposed to better standard of coaching. And we have a really special group of young players, especially the under 12, under 13 level, that is coming along quite quickly and doing very well as it relates. And that is because of the finances that the parents from these private institutions pump into that situation. As it relates to the coaching aspect, a lot of the players from the 2006 World Cup, etc., have their coaching license. I mean, I know Jason Scotland, Carlos Edwards, Ian Cox. I mean, they can name almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is they're not being employed because of the financial situation in Trinidad. They'll be better off, unfortunately, plying their trade in the UK. And many of them, I know Jason's at Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Cox is still with Gillingham, coaching at the youth level. And it's a bit of a travesty because Trinidad and Tobago now really needs these types of persons back on the island, coaching at the grassroots levels, being able to implement at a wider level, and not just in little cliques and,
yeah,
little pockets of society.
Yeah, I get it, and it is. I mean, you're right. It is a travesty, and what's going on? You were talking about Champions League, and I wanted to switch it over real quick before I kind of hit, you know, make that sharp right turn on. Or a sharp, you know, that sharp right turn. You know how you guys drive over there. What exactly of the Champions League did you see from a Caribbean standpoint that's really stood out? As far as, I mean, obviously Liverpool is probably the big story in the Caribbean, or at least on that side of the Caribbean, or, you know, the English speaking side of the Caribbean, if you will. How have you seen that develop? And of course, you're going to be doing a lot of Champions League coverage down in Jamaica in the coming weeks. So, you know, I know that you're starting to get ready and, you know, sinking your teeth into that.
Well, it's been a very interesting conundrum, and I would say quite right off the bat that if at the start of the Champions League you would have named these four teams as the four semifinalists, you would have been a very, very wealthy man. Simply because I don't think anyone would have thought that this would be the final four teams. But that being said, the semifinalists and the semifinal games, particularly the first leg, wasn't short of excitement, entertainment, high octane games and high impact games. I think what impressed me the most is the attacking prowess of all the teams that has played so far. Once they've attacked, you see good movement, a lot of guile, trickery. And for the purist and the neutral fan that is sitting watching these types of games, it's been extremely entertaining. But the flip side of it, and the one that I tend to struggle with a little bit, is the type of defending that we've been seeing over the course of these semifinals. I want to use the word amateur or schoolboy, if I'm permitted to, but some of the
you just did, so I mean, yeah. I didn't stop you, so why not?
Yeah, some of the defending and what you've seen and the horrendous mistakes that have been made at this level, at the highest level of the game, at games that are at really high stake, you have to wonder, you know, what is happening and what is going on, and of course, Liverpool Roma game, the first leg, you have to, that's the first thing that comes to mind. And what I saw is just a bit shocking and of course hard to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, from my entertainment point of view, we've seen some really gifted players and some of the best players in the world show off their attacking prowess and show off their ability. You know, it's a tournament where Real Madrid, of course, who before the start of the tournament would have been one of the favorites to retain the title, have gone on to make the finals in a very unorthodox way. I don't think they've played particularly well. And you could date back to the quarterfinals against PSG. Sorry, even before that, but PSG.
Even the group stage.
In the group stages, they just have not sparkled.
Yeah.
But as we sit here, they're already into the finals. And as you would know, the finals is a one-off game, and of course they can put together the type of performance that can blow any team out the park, whoever the second finalists will be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's simply because of the type of quality and talent that they have within their squad. So that has been a strange, obviously, phenomenon. And of course, Liverpool and the emergence of a new world star in Salah, and what he's been able to do on the pitch. And I know we've always had the conversations with Neymar and Messi and Ronaldo, and it's a breath of fresh air to see a new name being called and even being chimed as a possible Ballon d'Or World Player of the Year winner. So when you start, you know, looking at the holistic view of the Champions League, as I said, it's from a neutralist point of view. And here in the islands, Jamaica and Trinidad, the bars and shops and stores and restaurants are packed to capacity because of the interest that these games have held over here. As you know, the European clubs are well supported.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, that's true. And very
people
true.
People are quite fanatical about it. I think from a Caribbean perspective, a Liverpool Real Madrid final will really whet the appetites of both sets of fans, and even from a neutral perspective as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I know you guys over at Sportsmax will be doing a lot as far as, you know, the coverage leading up to that match, and of course a lot of analysis as well for those of you listening and in the Caribbean. And it's interesting you mentioned that, a lot of schoolboy defense, and of course Sven Ulreich, the butt of a lot of jokes at the end of the day yesterday, and of course leading into the final. But also, you saw Bayern Munich side that looked much better than Real Madrid, but it's just those moments where they had lapses in concentration. I think that's where Real Madrid really thrives on, taking advantage of those mistakes. And that's where the opposing teams really haven't realized that if they don't give those opportunities, Real Madrid is going to, you know, eventually have a lot of problems and maybe even lose. And Real Madrid's been not lucky, but they've been very fortunate and very, very opportune in those circumstances as well.
Yeah, I would say they've been very lucky in some of the things that, you're right. It's very rare in a competition like the Champions League that a team can have so many consecutive bad games and still go through. The law of averages in the sport would suggest that at some point it will bite you in the butt. And for some reason, Real Madrid have been able to continuously go through, even with what I would say questionable selection policies. I mean, if you look at the game, the second leg, I just couldn't fathom what Zinedine Zidane was thinking as Kovacic came on for Casemiro. I mean, and of course, which inspired Bayern Munich to basically absolutely overrun the Real Madrid midfield, and in particular, having Lucas Vazquez play a makeshift right back and Modric as his cover. And that almost cost Real Madrid the game because Frank Ribery and Alaba basically lived down Real Madrid's right-hand side. But despite all of these things that we're seeing, they've managed to come out unscathed and being able to move on. And you would have to think that the football gods seem to have something especially planned for them, the way that they've been able to keep moving on. You have to think to yourself that, of course, with the lead that Liverpool have, that they are going to, you know, go on to the final here. And you have to ask yourself, would they be able to navigate themselves around a Salah, Mane, and Firmino? And I think that is the question moving ahead.
And here with Brent Sancho on Beyond the Pitch. And you know, I mean, all of that's going to be interesting to look at because of you know, the way things are playing out. And I honestly think that if this Real Madrid side plays like they did yesterday, plays like they did throughout the entire, save for the 3-0 against Juventus in Turin, Liverpool. Yeah, I'm thinking about a trip I have to make later on this month, so all of a sudden I'm getting my L's mixed up. Liverpool have a tremendous opportunity to beat them based on the way Liverpool's playing at the same time. But again, it comes down to Liverpool not being so leaky in the back as they've tended to be throughout the past few years.
Yeah, and I think from a Liverpool perspective, man, there's a lot of Liverpoolian fans here in the islands are salvating. Of course, they haven't had domestic success as it relates to the league titles in England, and they haven't had overall success even in Europe for quite some time. And this team really, even the neutral fans would lean towards them. They've really captured the imagination of football-loving fans here in the Caribbean. And I think they would, you know, from the people here in Ireland, Would love to see a Liverpool upset the apple cart in the finals if it does come to that. And it's simply because of the free-flowing football that they've been playing. It's been an absolute joy to watch once they're in on song. And I'll even go as far as to say that if they're on song, I don't think there's many teams in the world that could stop them, if any, once that front three is on the front foot and having a good game.
I'm going to switch it up for you because this is something I've really been curious about and not something that was really talked about a lot. Well, obviously, it's still being talked about. The final result was being talked about, you know, to this day, at least here in the United States, was that night in Cuba. And not even that night, because you told me you happened to be with the team or around the team in the days leading up to that match against the United States, correct?
Yeah, I was in and around the team, and I did some coverage for the local television and radio station leading up to the game. As you would know, when Trinidad and Tobago had absolutely nothing to play for, and in fact, there was a lot of conversation within the group that Coach Lawrence was looking to make wholesale changes, which he did, and look at the game more as a you know, players to cut players' teeth and get some bit of international exposure. And I think, obviously, as we know, leading up to the game and the type of rainfall that we had in Trinidad at the time, and I think once the statement happened, it happened in the morning, and of course none of the daily newspapers would have had it, but the social media aspect of it, once that took off, it was the talk of the town in Trinidad. And I think the game went from being a non-entity for Trinidad and Tobago to a must-win situation because of what was said in the press. And again, the statements coming out from the U.S. camp and of course, the lack of respect and the disdain that was shown towards, of course, the facility and the country in whole. I think a lot of Trinbagonians look at it as, of course, not just as a challenge, but as a disrespect, and as I said, the country's interests, which was turned away from the game, was turned to the game, and by the country's interest turning, the players that were part of the national setup, of course, started to feel the pressure of having to get a result against the United States, and I think that's when things went from bad to worse for the Americans.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but really, I mean, take us through that experience, because not a lot of people know about what exactly was said, because it wasn't reported here in the United States for the most part. It was kind of, well, you know, yeah, they've had a little bit of fun. Okay, boys will be boys, whatever, you know, and it was looked at as a formality, in other words, and not a lot was talked about the comments, about what was going on, about what was being said. If there was anyone that said it happened to be Shaka Hislop the day after, talking about the arrogance of the United States men's national team and the U.S. setup. But not really was talked about as far as what this, you know, about what was said and the context behind it. So that's the reason why I'm asking you. I mean, take us through that and what occurred there.
Well, I don't remember the statement verbatim, but I remember what was understood by what was said. And it's basically, it came across that Trinidad, look at this third world country and the third world type of stadium, that they don't even have proper facilities to play an international game. So that was the feeling around the fans in Trinidad and Tobago, the people of Trinidad and Tobago. The actual words that were said, I don't recall the actual quote, but I know what the feeling was in the country, and that was the feeling amongst people. It looked like the U.S., and a shocker, rightfully say, was arrogant and looked down at Trinidad and Tobago as it relates to the facilities, the people, etc. So the one statement spiraled out of control to have these definitions that were being portrayed by the people in Trinidad and Tobago, that of course would have been conveyed onto the national team. So it moved quite quickly, as I said, to a statement, to a definition and an understanding and a feeling about the Americans, in particularly the U.S. men's national program and the U.S. men's national team. So that feeling was harbored And the thing about it, Juan, it happened, I think, 2 days before the game. So it gave itself enough time to fester and became a general feeling amongst not just the people of Trinidad and Tobago, but the Trinidad and Tobago Mencina camp, who now looked at it as the feeling against an opposition that feels that way about them.
And what I mean, were the players saying, "Oh no, oh no, 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 that you know, you didn't go there. Okay, guys, let's go get them." You know, I mean, see, it wasn't. You know, they were like, "Okay, we're gonna beat you," but never did you imagine that everything else would fall into place where the U.S. was gonna be eliminated from the World Cup. I mean, that's what really accentuated that match even more so, especially with how things were going on in a simultaneous manner. You're seeing all these results build up. Oh wait, this could be huge.
And I think that the feeling wasn't necessarily to knock the U.S. out the World Cup. The feeling was that we are not going to let you beat us, especially with the type of things that you're saying and the type of feelings that was festering on the island from the statement being made. And the players, of course, started to roll their sleeves up because, as you would know, once the nation starts feeling it, the players camped in Trinidad and Tobago will start picking up on that feeling. Their friends, their families, through social media, other mediums of conversation, would have been transpiring these types of feelings to them, and they would have felt it necessary now to go out and get a result because of the pressures being put by outside influences, and of course from the stuff that they're reading from social media, and the general newspapers started running stories as it relates to the disrespect and arrogance by the Americans.
That's tremendous. I mean, it's really difficult to understand why something. So in other words, I mean, people took it as the step beyond overconfidence. And mind you, I mean, if Trinidad were in a position going into whatever country and they knew they only had to have 1 point, there would be a bit of relaxation, especially after beating a team in a convincing manner like the U.S. beat Panama 4-0 just days before. There would be a bit of I don't know, swagger for lack of a better term. But I guess they took it overboard. And I mean, what were some of the, what was, and you happen to be at the camp and you happen to be around, what were some of the things that the players were doing or the body language that the players were doing that had in order to make those things really, I don't know, really fester a little bit more within Trinidad?
Well, I was able to be with the team before the statement was made, and there was a sense around the camp that, let's just finish up the World Cup campaign, win, lose, or draw. Meaning that the result didn't mean much. It was about getting some of the fresh players a bit of international playing time. And of course, the players were disappointed themselves in their hexagonal performance. So it was really just running out the league format and running out the fixtures. But once the statement was made, and as I said, it happened in the morning 2 days before the game, I believe, the entire mood of the camp changed. They trained, the Trinidad and Tobago team trained that afternoon, and what was lackadaisical and what was, you know, what was pedantic turned into more professional, turned into, you know, a faster, crisper feel around the camp. And there was a certain level now of determination that wasn't there before the statement. There's a certain level of desire that wasn't there 2 days, a day before the statement. And, you know, a lot was made of the statement. And, you know, being on the island, I can tell you, that statement really changed things for that tie. You know, we would never know what would happen if that statement wasn't made. But I can tell you, the feel and the mood of the Trinidad and Tobago camp and around it was different before the statement was made as it relates to it was after the statement was made.
And did you talk to any of the players? What did they say? What did they think directly? Like they just went and started doing, you know, you just saw them a little bit more into it because the U.S. came out lackadaisical. They came flat. They came really difficult to get into a rhythm. And while Trinidad comes out, they score and things are going on. How is the mood in Trinidad? Obviously, within the crowd, you know, it wasn't a huge crowd to be honest, but still, you saw a lot of you know, reaction going on. But okay, how was the mood in Trinidad, especially when you start to see the other scores coming in?
Well, I think that the Trinidad public and even the team didn't really grasp the concept that the U.S. could not may not make the World Cup if they lose to Trinidad. I think the feeling was, and we would have to admit that, you know, Panama needed a result against a very difficult Costa Rican team. That was not in the mindset. I think the mindset in the players was the U.S. are not going to beat us here. And it was more about the actual game. The mood was more about the game itself and not about knocking the U.S. out of the World Cup. Trinidad and Tobago players wanted to win the game. The actual game itself, you could sense that there was a bit more desire, which is remarkable, in the Trinidad and Tobago camp. And I want to suggest that the U.S. team seemed a bit shell-shocked by the aggression, of course, and by the determination of the Trinidad and Tobago players. Because here's a team that's languishing at the bottom of the hex with absolutely nothing to play for, in theory, that is now chomping at the bits to get a result. And is on the field with tackles flying in, is first to every second ball, and putting in a real shift to get a result. And of course, a team that came to the island thinking, you know, we can say what we want. We can come here, just show up, put our boots on, walk onto the pitch and get a result. And that changed quite quickly. And as you rightfully said, especially when the goal scored, the confidence went to another level for the Trinidad and Tobago team. And I think that's where it all went wrong for the U.S.
And now towards the end, Brent, the result from Honduras comes in. The result from Panama comes in. Again, correct me on the chronology of how things happen. I don't remember exactly because it was just everything happened so quickly. Everything comes in. You know the results elsewhere, and then, you know, the referee blows a whistle. Match is over. U.S. is out. Was there a sense of like, you know, wow, we won, but then also, wow, we won, we knocked somebody out, we knocked one of the biggest teams in CONCACAF out of the World Cup?
I think the wow, we won factor was the night after the game, the actual minute the game was finished. The reaction by the U.S. players said it all, and I think that is what fueled the wow, we knocked them out the following day, because the Trinidad team was celebrating their victory. They were not, as I said, they were not celebrating while we knocked the U.S. out of the World Cup. The U.S. team's reaction, however, which was blasted all over the local newspapers and social media, etc., say, wow, we knocked them out, these arrogant guys that came to Trinidad and disrespected us. And that's when that feeling came in, the day after the game. The players themselves seemed to be quite content with winning the game, so especially the local, the bunch that played, because there's a lot of conversation about the failures of the team during the hex, and that was a big result for the players.
Brent, you know, the failures, I don't know if I mean, maybe failures is a little bit too harsh. Here's my explanation, and correct me where I could be wrong. The last time or the previous time that the U.S. played Trinidad, yeah, they did lose 3-0, but there were a lot of moments where Trinidad did handle the U.S. in terms of run of play. There was a couple of shots that hit the post. There was a couple of misses that came close. And that could have changed the tempo in that match. Trinidad, obviously, they defeated Panama. They also really held Mexico, you know, to one goal, although Mexico, you can also say, controlled the match. They weren't really going all out and looking to blow the doors right off of Trinidad when they played over in Port of Spain. When they played Costa Rica, it was a very difficult match for the Costa Ricans. So, I mean, a couple of bounces of the ball here and there, and they could have been able to maybe not qualify or even get to a playoff spot. They could have been in the argument if they would have been able to get a couple of points here and there.
Yeah, that's correct, Juan. And I think the reason why the disappointment was there, I believe, is because of the Honduras game in Trinidad. And the players got a lot of stick for that, the performance, which was arguably the worst performance in the Hex. You're correct. There were some very good performances by the team, and they were very unfortunate, if you remember, the disallowed goal in the Mexico game as well. That could have completely changed the tie. And you take all those things into consideration, and you would have had a decent set of games, or at least a couple of games you could point to suggest that Trinidad was a bit unfortunate not to be in the reckoning. And it goes to the fact that I think that you'd have to question the tactics and the philosophy for Bruce Arena coming into that one, because you would have known that Trinidad and Tobago could be a dangerous opponent on their day. And they've had these. They just were unfortunate with some of the results. So going into that scenario, I didn't understand the negative tactics that were employed for the game by the U.S., and of course, I didn't understand the mindset of the players and by extension, the coaching staff leading into it as well.
That's very true, and that was looked at a lot, but again, not really questioned a great deal in the run of things, at least not questioned in a more analytical manner. It would just say, hey, look, it's negative, but they don't exactly say what negative was. In general, although there were a couple of players like Jeff Cameron, of course, that came out and wrote their articles on what happened there as well. It would be a very intriguing novel for anyone to write as far as what happened in those days leading up to what occurred over in Cuba. Brent, it's been a pleasure. I know you have to run. Tell us what you're going to be doing in the next couple of weeks, you know, both Champions League, World Cup, and all that other good stuff.
Well, it's a bumper couple of weeks. Head back to Trinidad tomorrow, and then back again here next week for the Caribbean Club Championship with Central FC, where they face Arnett Gardens, Portmore United, and Dominican team Pantoja. In a four-team series, semi-finals, and then final on Sunday, trying to decide, of course, the Caribbean Club champions for this year. After that, I jet off to Russia, where I'm working alongside Gazprom, taking two kids to Russia, two 12-year-olds to Russia, to see the opening fixture of the World Cup. And in June and July, I head back to Jamaica to do some analysis stuff for the World Cup for Sportsmax. So it's quite a busy couple of weeks as it relates to football. You know, we're always excited when it's a World Cup year.
Of course.
Because, you know, there's so many different talking points, and we still have a FA Cup final to happen in the English FA. And, of course, we still have a Champions League final to speak about that would tidy us over straight into the World Cup, where I think there'll be a very entertaining couple of months for us football fans.
What do you think about that FA Cup final?
You would have to suggest that the momentum is with Manchester United. Jose Mourinho seems to be capable of getting a performance out of his team when needed. You only have to look back to the Man City win. They also beat Liverpool, and they also got a result against Tottenham in the semi-finals, despite playing very poorly during the course at some games during the course of the season, in particular the loss to West Brom leading up to the Tottenham game. So you know, he's done something correct as it relates to being able to get some sort of extra effort, and that's my concern, because I don't think Chelsea can get that extra effort because of the type of performance that they had. It seems like they're set on losing Conte. Excuse me.
Yeah.
So you'd have to suggest that Manchester United is there for the taking.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I was about to say, I was about to go into my diatribe and say, you know, let me just save your time. Yeah, you're right. I agree with you on that one. Brent, where can people follow you on some of your social media platforms, or you know, what have you as well?
I have my Facebook page, the Sancho Sports Foundation. We've been doing a lot of work with the young men and women of Trinidad and Tobago. Also on Twitter, and Brent Sancho, Brent_Sancho at Twitter. As well as you can find me on Instagram at Brent Sancho on Instagram. So
yeah,
I'm still coming to terms with the social media, but more and more as football comes along, I'm finding myself posting and tweeting a lot more, and Instagramming a lot more. Yeah, and I think the excitement is getting the better of me. So
yeah,
I'm excited, and I'm always willing to engage in and constructive football conversation.
Sounds good. And also, actually, I spoke to a good friend of ours that that wanted to, you know, send his regards, Mr. Keith Costigan.
Ah, yes, Keith is a former teammate of mine. We share quite close birthdays. We were actually very, very close teammates.
Yeah.
As we spend a lot of time together. We still keep in contact, and I'm really happy to see you guys doing so well.
Yeah.
He owes me
a couple of beers, so I'm still keeping that on my tab.
You'll be waiting a very long time for that.
Oh, you will. Okay, fine. Never mind. So I'll just see when we can get together in Jamaica, and he'll just pay for all three of us then. If he does, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, also, man, if you hope things work out, we get to see each other in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It'd be great, really, man. Really, you know, I'd like to get back together with the rest of the band. So,
yeah, I agree.
I agree. It's long overdue. Brent, thank you so much, and best of luck in Trinidad. Best of luck in Jamaica. Best of luck in Russia. And again, hope to see you soon.
Definitely. Thanks, Paul. You take care. Thanks, man. Take care.
Take care.